Today, I'm joined by Dr. David Morgan, a licensed psychologist with over 20 years of experience. He's a leading expert in corporate mental health wellness and an award-winning author. He shares insights on mental health, professional experiences, and parenting techniques. He also discusses the importance of intuition, the impact of physical health on mental well-being, and the societal factors contributing to the mental health crisis. Dr. Morgan also reflects on his own challenges and the importance of self-compassion and grace. Like and subscribe to support the show and make sure you don't miss out on future episodes. Welcome to another episode of the Deeper Than No podcast. Today I have Dr. David Morgan on the show. I'm super happy to have you, David. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Bennett. Thanks for having me.
David, can we start with a little bit of your background, what you've done in the past and what led you to, I was recently on your podcast around mental health with Silicon Slopes. Anyways, love to dive into all of that.
Yeah. So I'm a licensed psychologist. I've been doing that for more than 20 years. Got my PhD in counseling psychology from Brigham Young University. And we lived in the Pacific Northwest for about 25 years. And then about 3 years ago, my wife came to me and she said, we need to move to Utah and it needs to be in the next 2 to 3 years. And I said, how come? And she's like, I don't know. She just felt strongly about it. So we're here. We live in Provo now. And I've still been doing some remote work for Washington State, but I'm kind of pivoting my practice to more to a consulting model. And that's how I got connected with Silicon Slopes. Was probably 6 months after we moved here, I saw that their CEO was starting to do a lot of mental health related content. They were doing some town halls, and so I reached out to him and I said, hey, do you want someone who can be the torchbearer for this? Mm-hmm. And he said, fantastic. So that's where I became the director of mental health awareness for Silicon Slopes. And we started a mental health related podcast, and you were on the podcast, and that's how I met you. And that's why we're here today.
And remind us the name of your podcast.
That's called Mental Health Momentum.
Okay. Awesome. I haven't listened to them yet. You guys just started, right? But I do know you have one good guest, and that was me. I'm just joking.
We'll probably lead with that one, I think, just to make sure it gets up to a really good start. And then,
mental health momentum. Okay. I'm excited for those to start coming out so I can follow along. First question I want to ask is, you started with my wife wanted to move just because she wanted to move. That's like a gut feeling, inspiration or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't yours. It's a lot easier to follow. I don't know why I want to do this, but I'm going to follow it because it's my intuition. You're following your spouse's intuition. I want to dive in a little bit into that. And when you moved, did you already have something lined up here in Utah, or is it like, we're going to move and figure it out? Or give me that. That seems like a big leap of faith.
It was a big leap of faith. And the fact, I think that probably the reason that she got the intuition or the inspiration was because in my mind, I'm thinking we're just going to live in Washington for the rest of our lives because I've spent 20 years establishing a private practice. That takes time to get going and to develop, build a clientele and stuff. But then when she told me that, the first feeling I had was that's the right thing. And I should have naturally freaked out. I should have given her the laundry list of we can't do this because of this and this and this, and just rehearsed all the reasons why it wasn't going to work. But it immediately felt right. And so we've just kind of followed that. Because of COVID-19, there became a lot more flexibility in terms of, virtual work and stuff. So I've been able to do a lot of stuff virtually. We didn't really have things that were in place. In fact, the house that we bought, so she came out to look for houses and she looked and looked and looked and didn't find anything she wanted. But then she's with our realtor and she's like, I got to have a bathroom break. And so she says, okay, there was a new housing development that had a model home. And she thought, okay, well, I can go use the model home, go to the bathroom there. She walks into the model home and she's like, oh my gosh, this is the house. This is the house, or a house like this where we want to live. And so she talked to the people there. Everything was sold. There's a bunch of new construction. Everything was sold. And we thought, okay, well, maybe they'll have a new development somewhere else. And then about maybe 2 weeks later, she's on Zillow and a home pops up. We thought it was the model home, but it was one of the homes in the neighborhood that a buyer had backed out of. And within 12 hours, we had put down earnest money and signed a contract. We hadn't even seen the place, just
When
in
was
pictures.
this?
And so
What?
that was like April 2022, I think.
Okay. Yeah. So you couldn't wait more than 12 hours, or else the home was gone.
Seriously, right? Exactly. That was back when houses were flying off the shelves. And so so we put our money down and moved in, and it's perfect. I got a view of White Mountain right out my window, and I love it.
Awesome. What did you do with your 20 years of clientele and from your private practice that you built up? What's happened with that?
Some of it I've transitioned here. Just the there's basically there's lots of different rules about where you can see clients from, where they have to be. And so some of that was able to work here. Some of it I handed off to a colleague who was I had been kind of training up to that end anyway. And I was really trying to transition out of clinical practice anyway, which I'm still doing. I'm more into the business corporate space right now, and basically teaching businesses how to help their employees have better mental health. Helping businesses kind of figure different things at what they can do to improve, quality of work and messaging and those sorts of things, so that their employees have better chances to have good mental health.
Yeah. Well, one thing that just came to mind when you're talking about, like, when your wife said, "Let's move to Utah," and your gut reaction was like, "Okay, let's go do it," rather than focusing on the laundry list of negatives. I was listening to Disney purchased Pixar when Steve Jobs owned Pixar, and it was the CEO of he was just appointed CEO of Disney, and there he's trying to say, "Hey, let's buy Pixar." And it's $7.7 billion, new company,
Bob
all of this.
Iger.
Yes, Bob Iger and Steve Jobs, and they say, "You know, I want to buy your company," and they list all the negatives, and then they had like two or three positives, and it could say Disney and Disney Animation, and so he's like, it sounded like they weren't going to go through, and Steve Jobs said, "No, a few strong pros will outweigh dozens of negatives." And then you look at what happened in Disney Animation. They produced Frozen, and on that deal alone, they almost profited $7 billion. You know, and they were attributed
That's
to,
great.
acquiring Pixar. So, anyways, small amount of pros do outweigh cons. I love that you jumped into that. Psychologist, when did you decide to be a psychologist? And then I wanted to see if that ties in to what your definition of success is, and if that your definition of success attributed to your decision to pursue that career.
So I always thought I wanted to go into mental health, probably as early as high school. I just felt like a connection with people, and I thought I was always good at dispensing advice. What I had to learn about the first 2 years of my graduate studies was how to be quiet, because that's what makes a good mental health professional, is a lot of listening and less feed and less talking. And then when I got to college, I thought I wanted to be a psychiatrist. So that would be to go through medical school, and then that's the medical specialty, like an oncologist or gynecologist or whatever. Psychiatry is just another specialty. And there were a couple of situations that happened. Biology 200 happened, which was so hard. And I was like, oh my gosh, I don't know if I can do so much chemistry and biology. I didn't know if my commitment to psychiatry was that strong. And then when I was serving a mission for my church, and we were playing basketball, and one of my companions got elbowed, and he got a laceration to his lip. So I took him to the urgent care, and as they were stitching him up, I almost passed out just watching them put the stitches in his lip. And I thought, I don't think I'm going to make a very good physician if I do this. And so I thought, well, I'll do psychology instead. And that was a little less. It's 10 years of college to be a psychologist, about 12 years to be a psychiatrist. I'm much happier that I became a psychologist, because in psychology, it's just pure mental health. I mean, all it is mental health all the time. No worries about medication, no worry about anything else. It's just the counseling and the evaluation and assessment. And that's been, and I like that. I mean, there's places for that other stuff as well, for sure. But I've really enjoyed being able to help people change by, them changing the way they think and approach their lives.
I love that. How much of what you work on, I mean, psychology again, mindset and paradigm shifts and all of that, How much does the physical relate to it as well? I mean, are there, you know, you often hear the importance of just movement and blood flow and exercise and all of that. And anyways, love to hear your feedback on the mental versus physical and how those relate.
So when I was being trained, that was back in the 1990s. I was at BYU from 90 to 99. And there wasn't so much of an emphasis on it back then. And we didn't have any classes on it. It was just more focused on the mind, a little bit on the brain, just so we could understand, you know, kind of basic brain physiology, neuropsychology, and those sorts of things. So, and that's been, you know, 25 years now. And now there's a much greater emphasis. What we're finding is that mental health problems are just a composite of many, many different issues. And there may be, for, you know, depending on the individual, there may be some folk, you know, like maybe their cognition is a little more important for them. Maybe some for someone else, the physical is more important, and that might have a greater influence. But to just say, I'm going to just take one single approach, all we're going to do is therapy, you don't have to change anything else, I don't know that that's going to be effective. Or all you're going to do is take medication, you don't have to do anything else. Or all you're going to do is change your diet, you don't have to do anything else. I don't think that works. I think you have to look at it as a multifaceted problem that needs a multifaceted solution. So physical, 100%. We got to get in better shape. We got to think about what we eat, what we're putting in our bodies, what we're doing to our bodies. All of that is going to affect the system in some way.
Yeah. I'm interested to hear your thoughts on, you know, the mental health crisis that we're in, more anxiety, more depression, more diagnosed illness. What I heard it was from a psychologist, Jonathan Haidt, who wrote a book called Coddling the American Mind. It was basically, we are helicopter parenting. Kids cannot, they're not building confidence. They don't know how to manage risk. And then he also threw in the expectation versus reality equals our happiness. Social media is raising the expectation of who we should be, how often we should be traveling, how much money we should be making, but the reality stays the same. And that's creating a larger gap. And from my experience, I mean, that all sounds, sure. What are the other theories out there that are leading towards, you know, much higher rates of mental health illnesses?
So one of the things about mental health is that it's all self-report. It's not like I went to my doctor 6 months ago for a physical and they drew a little titer of blood and they were able to look at a bunch of things in my blood. You know, they were able to tell if my cholesterol was too high, if my sugar levels, those sorts of things. They took my blood pressure with a cuff and they were able to assess it. They didn't say, hey, David, what's your blood pressure? Give me an estimate of your blood pressure. You know, where do you think it's at? They didn't do that. And they didn't do that with my blood sugar or my cholesterol or anything. Mental health is all self-report. If you go into a psychologist or a counselor and you say you're depressed, she's probably going to ask you a bunch of questions to try to get an assessment of that. But it's all based on what you say. And you could answer every single question in the affirmative and you're going to walk out of there with a diagnosis of major depressive disorder, severe, without psychotic features. And it could be, you could be honest or not. So I think what's happening is as mental health is becoming more acceptable, you know, we're saying, hey, it's okay to have mental health issues. Then people are saying, okay, well, then, okay, yeah, I will report that I feel depressed or I will report that I feel anxious. And I think that might be contributing to some of the elevated incidence rates we see. I think in the same vein of looking at mental health as a multifaceted problem, I think when we're trying to explain what's causing mental health, we don't need to look at simple explanations either and say, oh, well, it's just this or it's just that. It's going to be a combination of all that. It's going to be social media. It's going to be well-meaning parents who don't want their children to suffer and unfortunately causes a little bit of suffering as a result. I think it's a result of maybe even some over-reporting because people are feeling extra safe and saying, okay, well, now I can finally talk about this. I think there's probably a bunch of reasons. One of the things I don't like is this idea of, well, we just need to be like it was in the 80s when I was growing up, and we just need to get back to throwing the football. And I mean, I remember kicking a soccer ball down the street till my foot was numb. You know, I would just go out there and kick and kick and kick and kick. And literally the top of my foot, it had no sensation. And that's what we did then. That's not what we do now. And I don't think the solution is to transport us back to the 1980s. It's to find out what's today's solution with the issues that youth have today, in connection with social media and with, you know, this kind of new style of parenting? How are we going to address that?
Yeah. You mentioned the higher self-reporting, and again, going back to the Jonathan Haidt, when I kind of first got interested in mental health, he was showing a statistic and he addressed that. He said, you know, a lot of people, because it is self-reported. So is it just that we're more comfortable as a society? And he brought up a stat that showed girls 9 to 14, their rate of hospitalization went up by 259% from 2010 to 2015. Sure. So he's like, no, these are people actually harming themselves. So anyways, just wanted to throw that out there because I do think, and I'm not saying that you disagree with me, I'm sure you'd agree with that. But it is on the rise, both on, you know, people being more comfortable talking, but suicide rates, self-harm rates, all of that. I mean, it's real, it's happening, and it is extremely concerning. The biggest thing that
no question about it. Well, I was just going to say that. So I guess the question is, in the 1980s, were people self-harming and not talking about it? We don't know, right? And so maybe so who knows? Are we just getting a clearer picture of what's been happening all along, or is the incidence rate actually increased? We don't really know the answer to that. I don't think anyone, you can't tell, you can't go back into the 80s and say that. At the end of the day, we just have to look at what is happening. And I guess it makes some sense to try to say, well, and maybe this is what's causing it. But even if you find out what's causing it, you still have to talk about solutions. And so I think the more solution focused we could be, the better.
Yeah. When I got really interested in it is because I heard that stat and I'm like, okay, well, I have kids, I have girls. The hell do I do as a dad? Do you have kids, David?
Yeah, but the youngest is 21.
Okay. Still have kids though. So this question will apply. Okay. What parenting techniques have you used? Did you use, are you using as a result from your professional training?
So most of my, in my professional work, I relied a lot on theories that kind of address the idea of if we're being irresponsible in trying to meet our goals, then we end up having more mental health issues. The more responsible we are, the less mental health issues we tend to have. And it could be the example of if I want to get rich, then I could responsibly get educated or get trained in something that can make money, work hard at that, spend less than I earn, and I can eventually become rich. Or I could rob a bank and I could become rich that way. One's a responsible way, one's an irresponsible path. And we do this throughout our lives and what we're trying to accomplish. So with our children, it was just very matter of fact. I remember having a conversation with one of my sons when he was a young adult, and he was just involved in a number of things that were irresponsible. And I sat him down and I said, you know, you probably, the results of the path that you're on are going to lead to any number of potential outcomes. And I kind of graphically described some of those outcomes, and they all stunk, you know, they were all terrible things. And I said, I'm your dad, and I'm going to be there at the end of every one of those things. I will be there to pick up the pieces. I will be there to bail you out of jail. I will be at your court hearing, whatever it is, right? Because I'm your dad. The question is, do you want that for yourself? I mean, do you want to end up in those things? And I think that for him, that really struck home because he said, he didn't tell me right then, but he started to change his behavior shortly after that because he says, I don't want those things. I'm not making this stuff up as a parent. Life has its way of kind of, you know, jerking you around. And if you can learn to live within the confines of that to a certain extent, then I think you're going to be happy. If you assume I can do whatever I want, whenever I want, you can't. There's going to be consequences that are going to be unpleasant. So learn those boundaries, live within them. And so that's what we tried to do. We just kind of tried to show them the guardrails and say, this is why they're here. They're here for a good reason. We had the same guardrails. We're not making this stuff up. Do what you want. We'll be there to pick up the pieces. And fortunately, they were all very smart. And so they, adolescence is always rough, but as adults, they've settled into some pretty good patterns.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, it's explain, empower, support, love. Don't just say, because I told you so. This is the way 100%. Because I told you so.
Because I told you so works till they're about five, maybe, I think. And after that, especially if they have any sort of above average intelligence, they're going to go, what are you talking about? You know, the youth today, I love them because they're inquisitive. They want to know, they want to learn. And so we can just teach them. We're not making this stuff up either. You're not making it up. You're teaching them things that you learned growing up, things you learned by hard experience sometimes. And you're like, hey, don't do this just because it's crummy outcome. You won't like it either.
Yeah, but at the same time, you're saying, here's your options. If you do this, this is the likely outcome. You know, educating, exactly. They still have that decision. And you're not saying, don't do that. Because I think there's so much of that, you know, human nature, a lot of times, like, you're going to tell me what to do. I'm going to resist it because I don't want to be told. I want to be a free agent, you know. And that's a big thing that I use as well in parenting. You know, it's like, I don't want to go to school today. Okay, if you don't go to school, these are the potential outcomes. What do you want to do? And man, the responsiveness that you get towards that versus you have to go because everybody goes. And it's like, I don't know why we go to school 8 hours a day. Like, I don't know. That's just what we're doing. And if you don't, these are the potential outcomes. And if you do, these are the potential outcomes. Like, what do you want to decide? So anyways, love that answer though. As a licensed psychologist, what do you do to stay active, proactive with your mental health?
You know, it's interesting because as when you're in mental health, you talk about it all the time, you know, and sometimes I feel like a pulmonologist that smokes, you know. I'm like, you know, because I'm thinking, well, I'm not doing everything I should be doing, you know, even though I know what I should be doing. I think the key for me is really just trying to, like I said, approach life responsibly, saying, look, what's going to be the most responsible outcome for me? We recently hired a dietitian because I want to lose some weight and I want to feel healthier. I want to eat better. And I love what she's been teaching us. And she talks about talking about giving. She says, is this a gift you want to give to your future self? I thought, oh, I love that, because it's like, so me not eating as much today is a gift to my future self, or me exercising more today is a gift to my future self, as opposed to a gift to my immediate self. And I can make that decision if I want. There's some days when I say, you know what? I just want a gift for my immediate self. I want to eat that, you know, that whole cookie, you know, or I want to eat that whole box of donuts or something like that. But understanding the consequence of that, then I can make an informed choice. I think it's being, like you said, being proactive and looking at situations, not letting life manage you, but you managing your life. And that's been key for me in just trying to keep things balanced.
Absolutely. I love that. I guess shifting to biggest mental health challenge, or one of the hardest, you know, times emotionally, mentally that you've had in your life. If you could walk us through that, and what were the philosophies or practices that you incorporated to lift you out of that and overcome that challenge?
Sure. So we're members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and which has a missionary force. You see walking around with the black tags on. And so our oldest son, he got called to serve a mission and came out to Provo. We were living in Washington. And came out here to study. He got called to Madagascar. He was assigned to serve in Madagascar. What we didn't know is he had a ton of underlying anxiety, and he only lasted about 8 weeks in the training center and then got sent home because he just had this massive, massive anxiety meltdown. It was a very difficult thing for us because he came home and he was angry and he was sad and he was, you know, distressed, and it was really kind of a rough time for us. I remember just feeling so bad because I thought, I'm a psychologist, for heaven's sake. I mean, I should have seen this coming, right? My own son who gets sent home for this massive undiagnosed anxiety. I'd known him for 19 years at that point and still haven't seen it. And I thought, is this just something I didn't want to see? Was I ignoring signs? Because I thought, oh, my kids don't have mental health issues, which they all do, practically every one of them. And that's okay. And then I remember visiting with one of my friends, and I was just kind of kicking myself for any number of things, you know, things I could have done better. And hindsight, of course, is so clear. And he said to me, he said, "You did the best that you could have with what you knew at the time." He says, "I know you as a father, David. I know that you're a conscientious father. You're not a slacker. You're trying to do your best. So I know that when you were raising your son, you were doing the best with what you knew." And that was comforting to me because I thought, you know, that's right. And then I realized from there that regardless of what we do, there's going to be bad outcomes. There's always going to be bad outcomes. Life just happens. And you can't say, "I'm just going to do everything just right, and then everything is going to turn out on this path." It will not happen that way. But just being able to give myself that flexibility and saying, it's okay to do your best and not have it work out. It's okay to some days not do your best and not have it work out. You're trying the best you can every day, and get back up, keep moving forward, and do that. And so it was eye-opening for me. I reflect on that. It's been 10 years, more than 10 years now. And I reflect on that regularly when I think about, you know, mistakes or bad decisions, to say, you know what? I was doing the best I could yesterday, and maybe it wasn't the greatest, and that's okay. Try better tomorrow.
That is by far the number one belief or mindset that's helped me. Realizing that at any given moment, you have a time machine. Go back to that moment when you should have recognized that he had anxiety. What, you know, your brain didn't recognize it. And that's it. Like the thought to ask him more, but like it just didn't arise in your mind or whatever. And that's it. And it, having that mindset does allow you to look back at life, yourself, others' mistakes with an infinite amount of grace, gratitude, love, empathy, sympathy. So I love that. And I also like that example because it was an example of something that you went through per se. Like it was your son, but it's like, okay, well, what does this say about me as a father if he came home early or whatever? And anyways, can you dive into that a little bit more and with you as well as your wife? Because, you know, I served a mission as well, grew up in all of that. And I think the culture to like go and finish it is great and it allows more people to finish it. But I do think it's a little bit too much of like, oh, you didn't finish, you know? Like you should finish. Like I remember a friend's dad sending him off to a mission and he's like, "Come home." He's like, I don't care what you do, but don't come home for 2 years. Like if you don't finish your mission, go somewhere else, come home in 2 years." And I'm just like, man, that's a lot of pressure. Like, holy crap, why do they have to do it for 2 years? Anyways, love to hear a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I think we were stuck in the culture as well and just had that expectation. And I remember having a very poignant experience at church. We used to sit kind of close to the front, and then when our son came home, we were all the way in the back because we were just, you know, it was hard, and we were, you know, we felt ashamed, and he felt terrible. He didn't even want to go, didn't even want to sit there, and so when I was in the back, I had a different viewpoint around that because I could see everyone in front of me, and I was looking at all these men, most of whom were probably maybe my parents' age. And I had great respect for every single one of them. There were probably a dozen that I was looking at. And I remember in one meeting, I was looking at each of them, and I was thinking about some significant problem that they had reported to me just in the context of conversation or something I knew about, you know, maybe a divorce or you know, a child who was a drug addict or whatever, you know, I mean, all sorts of different things. And every single one of them had some sort of major event like that. And I think I had kind of judged them at the time. And I thought, well, they must have done something wrong, right? They must have, you know, been not as great a dad as they could have been, you know, reading the sports page instead of talking with their kid, whatever it was. But I had the greatest respect for every single one of them. And then and I and it really impacted me emotionally, and I felt very contrite. I felt very sad, and I almost wanted to go and ask all their forgiveness for kind of those negative thoughts and feelings that I had, or those judgments that I had made. Well, I liked them; they were all my friends, but I had some, you know, judgments that I had tucked away in my side pocket, and I just realized everyone out there is trying their hardest, And life is a, it's like a pachinko pinball machine. You drop, you think, oh, I'm just going to drop it here and everything's going to, it's going to fall this way. There's so many variables, so many things that can happen. We can do our best to try to forecast great outcomes, but there's just so much that's out of our control. And, but then like you were saying, that's okay because life goes on. And then you can, and you still have tomorrow to say, okay, well, what can I do now? Even if I did make a mistake yesterday, what can I do now to fix that? And then we have the benefit of having made the mistake and the wisdom in that. So I think it made us much greater parents. We actually had two more children who came home early from missions after that, and we were
Absolutely.
much better prepared as a result because we were like, okay, we know how to handle this, and that's okay. And people that judged us for it, we were like, all right, that's your business. I know how I feel about myself. And
Yeah.
anyway, yeah, it was a good learning experience.
And it could be true that the judgment that we perceive other people casting towards us is not even existent. Like, how do I view a
Exactly.
parent with a kid who comes home after 8 weeks due to severe anxiety? I have zero judgment against them. But if I'm that parent, then I'm like, oh my gosh, how people are judging me. It's way harder to give grace to ourselves oftentimes than giving grace to others. And we're just like, oh, they're thinking the worst. And our brains love to go to, or mine does, loves to go to the worst case scenario. And even sometimes worse than the worst case scenario, like, what if this happens? I'm going to die. And it's like, no, you're not going to die. You're physically safe. You have food. You have a roof over your head. Like, nervous system, chill the F
I did the most interesting experiment at BYU. It was when I was a fr no, it was when a sophomore. I think I was a sophomore. I was working early morning custodial at Smith Fieldhouse, and I went to empty a garbage can, and the garbage can was completely empty, brand new liner in it, and there was one Nike running shoe in it, brand new. It was my size, and so I put it in my backpack. I thought, what the heck? And then about 2 days later, I found in the exact same garbage can another Nike shoe. It wasn't a running shoe, it was a different type of shoe, but it was Nike and it was my size as well, brand new. I took it as well because I didn't have any running shoes at the time. So I would use them to run, two completely different shoes, but there was my only pair of athletic shoes. And I thought, okay, well, it's great. I'm running, who cares? And so I remember so weeks went by and it was like a Friday. I think I only had one class, and I didn't want to. Usually, I would get reasonably dressed up for class, and I was like, I just want to wear like sweats and my running shoes. But they were two different shoes, and I thought, okay, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to see how many people notice and how many people say something to me about, hey, you realize you have two different shoes on? I probably walked past 20,000 people that day, and if anyone noticed, no one said a thing, and that kind of led me to believe, just like you're saying, I think we have so much going on in our own lives. That when I hear like, oh, this happened to Bennett's family, I'm like, oh, that's great, or oh, that stinks, and back to my regularly scheduled programming, right? I mean, I've got like my own life to focus on. So I think you're right. I think we massively exaggerate what people are thinking. We put way too much burden on ourselves because of that. Just need to let that go and focus on my perception of myself and my immediate family, what I can do there.
Something that I'm working on right now, because I regularly see a therapist, and I've noticed that I just talk to myself all day, right? Your brain's always going, but I'm always justifying. I make an action and then I'm talking to somebody to justify that action. And I'm like, what I use to get rid of that, whether it's positive or negative, I just say, nobody cares what you're doing, Bennett. Like, really though, nobody cares. Nobody's going to ask you why you picked up this tool rather than that tool and why you're like, it's obsessive. And it's like kind of pounding my ego down, but like, I do think it comes from a sense of ego. Like, somebody, I have to justify myself. Maybe it's a lack of love or self-worth. Who knows? But it's just like, I come down to the no one cares. Like, nobody's worried about you. They're worried about themselves. Queen Elizabeth, I saw something like, she's one of the most prominent people that have lived in the last so many centuries. And somebody posted 6 months after she died. And they said, Queen Elizabeth died 6 months ago, and this is the first time you've heard her name since she died, and she was so important. Like, nobody's thinking about you. Even if you're the queen, you die, you're gone. Who, like, just focus on yourself and go. So I find that, even though it's a little maybe negative, like, Bennett, nobody cares about what the hell you're doing, I do feel like it's absolutely freeing, and it helps me break those mental cycles and those mental loops that I get in. So, David, I really appreciate you sharing everything. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, here's a 50 cents worth of free therapy. So it's a great first step, you know, and just saying, maybe that's where you start by just saying nobody cares. And then maybe you get to the point where you just say, you know what? This is the tool I want. This is the tool I'm choosing right now. And I think it's great, you know, and if I find out 10 minutes later, this is not the tool I need, then I'm going to pick up that tool over there instead. You know, you're just breaking it in pieces, breaking away from the perceptions of others, and then just solidifying your own self-perception and saying, hey, I'm smart enough to figure this out. Yeah.
But, I mean, for me, it also was a similar, I think I adopted that, like, oh, this is going to work just by telling myself no one cares. Because I did the same thing with business. Like, I have over 100 employees and everybody needs me or they're not going to survive. And then I'm like, what? You're not that important, dude. You nor your company, nothing. Like, don't put that extra weight on yourself, because at the end of the day, you're not that important and they're going to survive without you, just like they've survived their whole life before. So anyways, I do take the 50 cent advice. I will take your Venmo afterwards and shoot you over 50 cents. David, I really appreciate your time. Thank you for your insights on everything that you've shared. Where can our listeners connect with you?
They can go to my website at drmorganconsulting.com or drdavidtmorgan.com, either of those.
Okay, we'll include both of those in the show notes, along with a link to your podcast.
Awesome.
Okay, thank you, David.